Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Oksana Smerechuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and we're bringing you our feature interview, followed by some new music from Ukraine. And in our interview, we continue with the second part of the conversation on conflict resolution in the Donbas. Andriy Kulikov, who you may know as the CEO of Hromadske Radio, hosted three military experts who were visiting Ukraine. All three of them have extensive peacekeeping experience. General Sir Rupert Smith, expert on peacekeeping operations and security. Sir William Jeffrey, expert on post-conflict policing and disarmament, demobilization and reintegration with a focus on Northern Ireland. And George Anderson, an expert on political reintegration and decentralization. So here is the second part of the interview.
What mandate will a peacekeeping mission have, or might have, or what mandate is feasible for Ukraine? What is a likely size of the mission, and who would be the contributing states, or who might be, or who should be the contributing states?
The size, as I've said already, the size of the mission is... It will be dependent upon the agreement and the confidence in the agreement. Then you have to decide whether this, if you're going to deploy another group of people into this area, what their purpose is. Are they merely to observe and report, or are they to, and are they under any risk, in which case, should they be able to defend themselves, or are they to actually make the agreement happen? Now, those are three sort of stages in this thing, and involves a decision of principle as to what armed force is to achieve. And that will be needed to be done in the agreement.
How far removed from the conflict area should be the contributing states? For instance, I've heard that Canada is now discussing sending troops to Mali in Africa.
Now, I've heard that too. In a Ukrainian context, I mean, Canada's a member of NATO. So would it be acceptable to have countries which are part of NATO providing troops for peacekeepers? That's a political decision. I mean, there could be a balance. I mean, if some NATO countries might be accepted in exchange for some other countries on more or less on the other side, if I can put it that way. But it could be decided, no, we have to have countries which really have very little to do with this issue.
All right. What will happen to current administrations and people who work for current administrations in the non-government controlled areas? Or what happened to them in different countries where you were part of the settlement process?
I'm tempted to say pass on that one. I mean, I'm not sure that the analogy holds completely.
All right, very good.
Well, I think what we can say is that, you know, there are people who've been involved in the current administration in the occupied areas, which they're playing very different roles. I mean, somebody who's a nurse in a hospital or a low-level clerk, I mean, that's a very different kind of individual than somebody who's been one of the leaders or involved in the security apparatus in a very significant way. So this is the sort of issue that will need to be broken down into its constituent pieces, and presumably the way these individuals will be treated will vary according to the kinds of roles they've played. But again, I would say, come back to what Bill said, which is that one should avoid an approach which is vindictive and punishing. Try to minimize the extent to which, or at least be very reasonable in terms of the extent to which you're excluding people. Maybe you redirect some people to other parts of the administration and say you can't work in this area any longer, but a big part of what has to be done is to accommodate and bring people back in and to make them feel comfortable once again being part of the Ukrainian family.
I think that I have the feeling that this question was particularly referring to some sort of punishment which may follow for these people. But I would like to ask you to extrapolate or to answer my personal question, which stems from this. How far removed or, on the other hand, how deeply involved in the future political process should be, I mean, elections and local government, should be the people who served in local administrations in the non-government controlled areas? Any experience from other countries?
Well, what I would, you know, if you look at the history of the countries which were part of the Soviet sphere in Eastern Europe, they all went through what they called these lustration exercises, and they varied a great deal in terms of how extensive it was. Czechoslovakia was probably the most rigorous, but certain people were excluded from working in government or presenting themselves for public office. These are issues of judgment, but I would expect that there would be some implications for some people who've been involved in the current regime in the occupied territories.
In other areas where there had not been occupied territories as such, a similar issue arises in relation to those who were part of the insurgency. But the Northern Ireland experience, and the experience in Colombia as well, although it's different in character, is that part of the settlement is that a place is found in political life for those who have been, at least the political representatives of those who have been part of the insurgency.
I think that we also have a very interesting example of Nicaragua, which we now tend to forget, where although the Sandinistas have effectively won, the Contras were allowed to take part in democratic elections, and although the Sandinistas have won the first election, the next election brought victory to Contras, and then again change. How relevant is this to Ukrainian or to European experience, to your mind?
It has some relevance, I think. I mean, there's no easy answer to any of this, and the recent Colombian experience, for example, which was intended to provide a political path for the FARC, I won't say it's backfired, but it's certainly the case that in the recent elections in Colombia, the FARC's political representatives were remarkably unsuccessful. I think the main point is that a peace deal can be capable of accommodating, as an essential element, a political role for those who have been combatants in the past.
Sometimes Ukrainians ask very straightforward questions to which there are no straightforward answers. And now I think we go to one of such questions. Who will fund the restoration of Donbas? No comment.
We know. I think we know who will be expected to.
All right. How would people's civil rights be observed? I mean, is it only the responsibility of local administration or national government, or is there a place for international mission in this as well, General Smith?
We'll go back to two things we've already said, the nature of the agreement that is being put into effect, and in particular, the transitional justice arrangements that get you from A to B in this journey, if you like. Whether there are... the more it's done correctly by... the people who are going to do it, or the organisations and institutions that are going to do this in the future, as soon as possible, the better. Putting in an international body to do these things and then replace it by something else only delays the process from beginning, let alone developing.
I would just add on this that, you know, Ukraine is party to a whole number of international conventions on human rights, as well as having human rights provisions within its domestic constitution and what have you. So really, it's a case of respecting those provisions that Ukraine has already committed itself to.
To your mind, how are the Western parties of partners of Ukraine prepared to control the Ukrainian authorities in keeping, in observing those human rights? Or will they say, well, this is Ukraine? They are basically in their right and all this.
It's possible that one of the mechanisms that could be introduced into a case like this would be international observers, and certainly there's experience of that within Europe, with the organizations that exist within Europe. But they will not assume the powers of the sovereign country. They will be reporting, monitoring, etc.
But the best guarantor of human and civil rights is an agreement that protects them, and national institutions that operate legally and consistently with that.
But a strong message from the Ukrainian government about that it understands its commitments in this area could be a very powerful communication with the populations that might have concerns.
All right. Again, proceeding from your experience in other countries, the question is, what will be the status of the territory of the non-control or non-government controlled areas? How reliable is decentralization, and which documents will fix this? I mean, were there cases in other countries where the conflict inside, on if they were territorial, got a special level of autonomy within the state, where the maybe constitutional arrangements were changed as a result of the settlement process?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are any number of cases internationally, some of them following conflicts. The province of Aceh in Indonesia, there was a very bloody conflict there, but eventually it led to an agreement, and Aceh has a particular status now within Indonesia. In northeastern India, there have been a number of conflicts which led to sort of creating special states that resolved the issue. And then there have been peaceful arrangements that out of peaceful situations, such as South Tyrol in India, in northern Italy, the Åland Islands in Finland. There are a number of models for this type of thing. It's certainly a central issue when you look at the negotiations in Cyprus. Cyprus would certainly have two. They're talking about a bi-zonal structure where the Turks and the Greeks would each have very large elements of autonomy as well as a common government. So these things exist. But one of the issues for Ukraine is to what extent would there be a real demand and interest in having some particular arrangements for the Donbass area or the so-called particular districts within the Donbass area.
Now, a specific question. I think that our British participants have a very good knowledge of this process. How can disarmament of population be conducted peacefully? Well, maybe in your case, not of the population, but still you have in Northern Ireland, there is a huge experience of decommissioning weapons.
It was a huge issue, as you say, in Northern Ireland, and it held up progress on implementing the 1998 agreement for almost 10 years. The problem being that the IRA were very reluctant to give up arms. The agreement was clear about the commitment that the political parties were making to decommissioning within 2 years, including the Sinn Féin, which represents the IRA, but it didn't commit the armed organisations themselves. That meant there was a long period of further negotiation before arms could be put beyond use. And it held up the establishment of the political institutions because unionists were reluctant to sit in government with the representatives of an organisation that was still fully armed. So it can be a very problematic issue. And one of the things that I think one can learn from that is that it's, to the extent that it's possible, and it may not be, it's wise to be clear in any peace agreement about exactly how this issue is going to be dealt with.
General, from your experience, how can the disarmament of peaceful residents be conducted, and is there a place for a peacekeeping mission in this?
The peacekeeping mission can become involved in the collection of weapons, the certification that this force isn't there, doesn't have its weapons, or whatever is required of it, yes. But this requires this fundamental agreement to start with.
My last question is, again, from myself, and it also leans on the Northern Ireland experience. In Ukraine, we often hear the statement that you don't negotiate with terrorists. Now, not putting the stamp of terrorists to any part, any participants in the Northern Ireland conflict, but I think that there was a very interesting and useful mechanism whereby some armed groups that had their political wings, which could be involved in the negotiation process, thus bypassing the need to talk to those who had arms directly. What can you say? Any other experiences in other countries? And how workable was this?
I agree with you that the existence of a political wing and political representatives who are already taking part in elections is an advantage. It is still necessary to be clear about the terms in which they can be involved in discussions about a future peace settlement. But in my view, the settlement we eventually reached in Northern Ireland is much the stronger for having had Sinn Féin as the political representative of the IRA involved in its negotiation.
But there are cases, for example, in the island of Mindanao in southern Philippines, the Philippine government worked directly with the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. There was no fig leaf about a political organization. I mean, these were the rebels. The same with Aceh. The Indonesian people were dealing directly with the rebels. And some of the issues you're talking about, I mean, like getting people to lay down their arms, you really have to have a way of engaging the people who have the arms one way or another. I mean, maybe there's a fig leaf, maybe there isn't, but you do have to engage those people if they're going to comply with that part of an agreement and come to that kind of agreement and then comply with it.
I think having said that, it is a very emotionally charged and difficult issue because the terrorists have caused great pain, great harm, great damage and suffering. And the simple statement, we mustn't negotiate with terrorists, is a powerful one for that reason. I think, nevertheless, that eventually there has to be, however indirectly, some sort of dialogue with the people who are causing the problem.
And that doesn't mean they're absolved of everything they've done.
Not at all.
And so one of the issues that does arise, which is an issue to go into the agreement, is how are things like past crimes going to be dealt with?
General Smith, when you were commanding and taking part in peacekeeping missions, when there was a need to assess the situation on the ground and apply certain measures or to resort to some actions, who had the right of the ultimate decision? The military or the international officials? And how was this solved?
Well, it depends in the circumstances, and there are three cases in the 1990s when I was in the UN, I was in the general in Northern Ireland, and in NATO. In each case, there is a political authority to which I am answerable, Security Council, the North Atlantic Council in the case of NATO, and my own government in the case of Northern Ireland. And it's here that I said it at the beginning, it's helpful to distinguish between those things to do with the conflict, the actual acts of fighting and so forth, and those to do with the confrontation, the political underpinning of the whole business that you're engaged in. Now, as a general, you stand with a foot on both of those issues. But it's if you analyse it that way, it becomes clear whether your weight of is on the conflictual one or is this a confrontational matter, and you start to make the judgment accordingly.
Orthodox Easter is coming, and hopefully spring. Here's a song that has a somewhat dreamy, mystical sound by the Kyiv ethno-rock band Dox. They use a combination of modern and traditional instruments, ranging from a bass guitar to a sopilka to a wooden flute, a synthesizer and a dremba, which is known as a mouth harp or a Jew's harp. The amazing vocals are by Yulia Malyarenko and Maxim Berezhnyuk. The other musicians are Andriy Zaplotnitsky and Andriy Zholnach, Taras Peretyatko and Oleksiy Bekov. And the song is called Halochki. Enjoy!
Помыли ее рывы там за лесочком.
next week, we'll be back with more commentary on events in Ukraine. We'd be happy to receive any feedback from you. You can write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Oksana Smerechuk in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.